navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Lemon Street Gallery. The Introduction to the Potter's Wheel class will take place June 19th, 1 to 3 p.m., and June 26th, 1 to 3 p.m., for young adults 13 and up. Build confidence using a clay studio. Call 262-605-4745 for more.
This is WGTD-FM. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW-Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Jess Sheeler, an outreach and career transition specialist at Job Corps, Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW-Oshkosh, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Manji. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Good morning. I'm Dwayne Olson, your host today for Education Matters on WGTD-HD, Gateway Technical College, Kenosha, Wisconsin at 91.1 on your FM dial and 101.7 in Elkhorn, and 103.3 in Lake Geneva. WGTD is a member of the Wisconsin Public Radio Network. Before we begin, I want to indicate that this program was recorded a couple days prior to its broadcasting. Our program today focuses on current issues in Wisconsin public education, with particular emphasis on urban education as found in Milwaukee, Kenosha, and Racine. My guest today is Mr. Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School. Alan retired from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel after 37 years, the last 10 of which he wrote about education. As part of his activity at the Marquette University Law School, he now writes a weekly column on education for the Sunday Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome again to Education Matters, Alan. It's always good to have you as a guest here.
I'm glad to be here.
Great.
Invitation.
Let's get started then. We've never done this before, but I'd like to start today's program by discussing your most recent column, which was in the July 15th, 2018 Journal Sentinel, entitled Lessons from Improvement Efforts. Would you first summarize the column for us?
There's an organization called Schools That Can Milwaukee, which has been around for 8 years. And they offer basically coaching, mentoring, advice of all kinds to leadership development, I should add, to schools of all kinds in Milwaukee. And I think they've been a pretty good presence. I think they've done some good work. The head of the organization is a woman named Abby Andrich. She stepped down after 8 years at the end of June, and I simply asked her, what have you learned in doing this, and she gave me five answers, which I thought were, at minimum, really worth putting in front of people, and some of them I thought were very much on target for important points. So it's Abby Andrich's five answers to what have you learned.
Okay. You know, one of the first point that you have down there is we need to put kids first. And, you know, I was thinking about my own teaching career. And, you know, I mean, as a teacher I was a public school teacher for 12 years. And I don't know that I ever thought of myself. I guess I thought of maybe myself with kids and that sort of thing. But I never thought about putting myself first.
Well, I'd agree. And I think almost all teachers are in it because of their sense of mission about what they're doing, in the broader sense of the term, that they're doing it because they want to teach kids. They want kids to learn in advance, so they're in it for the kids. That said, they do want to get paid and have benefits and have decent working conditions. I think she was probably looking at both some broad picture things, but a number of specific instances in Milwaukee in which the Milwaukee School Board or others appeared to be weighing more towards job creation and job preservation, and sometimes not towards the quality of what's going on in schools. Questions about opening schools, closing schools, changing jobs. A few years ago, there was a big ruckus about food service in schools, and I suspect that was what was on her mind, was instances where preserving adult jobs appeared to be a higher priority than what was going to give kids the best classroom education they could get.
And certainly public schools have become much more complicated. Well, all schools have become much more complicated since I started my teaching career. So what feedback have you had from on the article? What additional thoughts have you had on school improvement since you wrote the article?
Well, the situation in terms of Milwaukee education advocacy, and I think this is true probably everywhere, Racine, Kenosha included, but no, coast to coast, maybe it's a little worse or a little more adamant in Milwaukee, is that things are so factionalized and so split. There was a lot of, you know, judging by who was retweeting the column and that kind of thing, and it was out there on Twitter. There was a lot of reaction from the people who would be aligned with schools that can, and in many cases people are aligned with the charter school movement or the voucher schools. Very little reaction from the public school sector. Like the two of them don't think alike, don't talk to each other, don't consider what each other has to say. So it was, I was not terribly heartened by this. I'd be more pleased if there was real dialogue between people of lots of different views.
Okay, and that gets to my next question about your June 1st, 2018 column. You focused on Dr. Driver's parting words about what needs to be done to improve the Milwaukee public schools. And she focused on polarization and the many ways MPS and the community are broken into factions that aren't coming together to help children learn. And if I recall, that same issue of the Journal Sentinel included a story on the lead in Milwaukee's water, which affects children's intellectual development and is one way that the city of Milwaukee could help children learn. So respond to this particular issue of the factions and its impact on children's learning.
Well, we in Milwaukee, and you've really got similar situations now in an increasing number of cities across Wisconsin, and Racine is a really good example of this, not so much Kenosha, because it doesn't have a voucher program yet. Well, sort of beginning, maybe. Everyone's in their own camp and associated with their own sector of the turf, and there's very few people who are looking at the big picture and what needs to be done in terms of how do we improve overall achievement, overall circumstances of schools in the city. How do we help the schools that are showing some real signs of being energized and effective, and do something about schools that are showing some real signs of not being very energized and effective. So the schism between the pro-voucher people and the anti-voucher people, between MPS and non-MPS, largely it's between the business community and in many cases the MPS, the public school advocates, community people. It's just a lot of division, and it might be arguable. I suppose I'd even agree that it's a little better than it was a few years ago, but it's still a huge problem. I think Dr. Driver felt that very strongly, that it was hard for her to advocate for what she thought was best for all the kids of the city because there was so much politics attached to it. And in her case, I think it involved more specifically, some instances in which she thought some charter school plans were good, and the Milwaukee Teachers Union and the school board were very resistant to that, largely because they were wanted to protect the public school turf. I think that hurt her a lot. Hurt her in terms of her political standing, and it made her feel like she was not being very effective.
I was just thinking here about Dr. Driver. She was very young, and I'm wondering if did she have enough background, you know, to be able to tackle the kinds of challenges that today's urban superintendents face?
Well, you could find people around here who would say that now and who would be critical of how she did her job. She was out in the community too much. She wasn't running the schools enough. That she should have had a superintendent's position somewhere else before she came here. I'm not so sure that's true. Yes, she was young. I believe she was just had turned 36 when she was named superintendent of Milwaukee Public Schools, and she'd been in Milwaukee for 2 years before that as one of the higher-ranking administrators in the system, but nonetheless was still pretty new to town.
Yes.
On the other hand, you know, how impressed should you be? Some people were and some weren't. She had a PhD from Harvard. She had worked in education in a variety of different roles prior to coming here, including starting out as a classroom teacher. So I don't think she was out of her league that I ever saw. In fact, she was quite impressive at times, describing what was going on, describing what she thought needed to happen. She had a strong command of all the details of what's happening in a big system like Milwaukee Public Schools. And her presence at meetings or in community events and such, she was, you know, very good at that. So I don't think she was out of her league. In fact, everyone loved her until the last few months, and then the tide suddenly turned. She was very popular in all sectors of the community, and then suddenly things went sour for a few different reasons. I think relations between her and the teachers' union, relations between her and the board, soured very quickly.
Anyway, that's too bad then, you know, given that she seemed to be then doing very well in terms of making some progress, bringing a really challenging community like Milwaukee or any urban community together around its public schools. Well, let's move on to Foxconn, which is a particularly big issue in southeastern Wisconsin these days. As well, it's an issue here in the state of Wisconsin as a whole. Since we're seen as one of the highest rates of unemployment in Wisconsin, what would you be concerned about as a member of the Racine Unified School Board to prepare its graduates for employment with Foxconn?
Well, that would be exactly it, to prepare its graduates. That Foxconn being right there next door to the city of Racine, and I'm not sure, is that property, the Foxconn land in the Racine United District?
It's in Mount Pleasant.
Yeah. And so it's a huge opportunity if it works out as it's supposed to, that there's thousands of jobs being created. You say, hey, this is great. And some number of these jobs are going to be not so demanding in terms of training and such. I mean, but a lot of them are going to be pretty high-tech, high-demand jobs. So, you know, to gear up your career readiness programs, to gear up, you know, one of the things employers, and I'm sure Foxconn will be the same, that they're looking for the most are what you would call soft skills, making sure people are good team players as employees, that they show up on time, that they have steady track records of getting their jobs done, that they cooperate well with other people, that they know how to follow orders, that they like, you know, that they can be trained to do what they need to do.
Yes.
But that they've got these skills of that are somewhat intangible that make someone a good employee. So really saying, can we prepare our people for these jobs, or are they going to end up going to people who are from elsewhere, you know, from 20, 30, 40 miles away or something?
At least, you know, that people in the school district can say, now look, let's get yourselves prepared because this opportunity is coming down the pike and they're going to be hiring people who are prepared.
Right. And if you don't have fundamental skills, decent reading skills, decent math skills, decent problem-solving abilities, and some of these, you know, character traits of accountability, resilience, determination, then you're not going to fit in with what they want. You're not going to fit in with what anybody wants in more higher-level jobs, better-paying jobs.
Okay, and from all appearances, I mean, Foxconn is here to stay, and thus those jobs will be there, and therefore it's incumbent upon the school district, obviously, to provide leadership, but also for the students to take advantage of this opportunity.
Whoever gets elected governor in November, and the Democrats are on one point or another on the spectrum of wanting to do something to change the Foxconn deal or to break it, that the state's giving too much money. Nonetheless, the vote's pretty much failing here, and whoever gets elected in November, I think Foxconn's a reality.
Right, exactly. Okay, let's move on to another issue here that's a big one here in the state of Wisconsin, the business of choice. According to the State Department of Public Instruction, DPI, in the 2018-19 school year, 222 schools will be in the choice program, an increase of 68 schools from the last school year. Kim Call, executive director of the Wisconsin Alliance of Rural Schools, indicated that, and I'm quoting here, we are now funding around 700 schools out of the same pot of money we used to fund 424 schools. Given the complexities of educating urban children, does this help to explain why urban students do so poorly on standardized tests and graduation and that sort of thing?
Going to your direct question, I don't know the answer if it explains why they aren't doing better. I think it might explain how deep the problems are in their roots outside of particular schools or particular types of schools, because they occur so much across the waterfront of all kids. What Kim Cockle was saying, to correct him, there's maybe, did he say 700? There might be 700 choice schools. My guess is a little bit less than that. There's about 120 in the city of Milwaukee, and the choice world is still concentrated here. And 424 is not the number of schools, the number of school districts.
Uh-huh.
The number of schools statewide is something like
1,500.
Right. In any case, if what he's saying is that the vouchers are weakening the public school system, that's a really interesting question. And you could find people who would give very strong arguments on both sides of that public schools, particularly, say, Racine, Milwaukee, where the voucher programs are older and much larger, have left the public school districts with more kids who have special ed needs, who have high levels of non-special ed needs, you know, chronic discipline problems, that kind of thing, and that the better kids are going into the voucher school. There's not much evidence, actually, to reach a conclusion on that one way or the other. I think it's true that the public schools in Milwaukee are ending up holding a bigger share of the special ed kids, but it's not as sweeping as the critics would say, that a lot of the voucher schools do have a fair number of kids. Overall, I think the best guess I know, and no one has an exact figure, is in the public schools, let's say in Milwaukee, the number of kids with what are called IEPs, the special ed plan,
right,
is around 20%, and the percent in the voucher schools is maybe 8 to 9, maybe 10%. So it's lower, but it's not zero either. And if you go into all of these schools, and I've been in lots of them over the years, that one of the things that's most striking is how undifferent they are, how similar they are. If you just look at a classroom full of kids and if you look at how they're doing and such, nobody's got the answer. Being in a religious school or a voucher school isn't overall yielding such great results. Being in the public schools isn't yielding such great results. The charter schools in Milwaukee, at least, are actually doing somewhat better, but they're still not that great as far as, hey, we've solved the problems. So I think the real issue, and we could debate the funding impact, which even there you'd get two sides to it, but the real issue is how do we get to kids in a way that sets them up to succeed in education?
Right.
And it really doesn't involve whether they're going to public or private schools, because both of them are having big problems.
Yes, and I'm just wondering if there's any urban school districts that are really being terrifically successful in terms of educating children, and nothing strikes me. I don't know that I've heard of any outstanding urban school districts. Now, there's some that are maybe considerably better than others, but nobody's got the complete answer.
Nobody's got the complete answer. That's absolutely true. I mean, hey, we have no problem getting our low-income and minority kids up to the same level as our high-income and white kids. Nobody can say that. It's just maybe in some individual schools or classrooms, but not on a larger basis. On the other hand, there are places where things are going better than Milwaukee, and they're not dealing with really very much different kids than here. There are places where there's been more progress in test scores, you know, other urban centers. I was just reading a piece yesterday about Denver, where the superintendent had been there for 10 years and is highly respected, just said he was stepping down and kind of had enough of the strain of the job, I got the feeling. But Denver is often held up as an example. Washington, D.C., that is, has obviously made progress just looking at their what are called their NAEP scores, the closest thing we have to an apples-to-apples basis for comparing schools. Boston. Frankly, Chicago has made more progress on a number of measures than Milwaukee has, not to minimize problems in Chicago, but there's actually been some momentum for improvement, graduation rates and test scores and attendance and other measures have improved in Chicago more than here. So there are places that are doing better than Milwaukee, and I think we, and by we I mean pretty much the whole state of Wisconsin, because Milwaukee is still the biggest center in the state,
right,
and so central to the state's economy, but we need to ask ourselves, how come we're not making more progress here, and what should we be doing?
And this gets back at drivers concerned about bringing the elements together, the groups together, to address this issue about what should we be doing to
Abby Andrich's concerns also, and I think both of those people would agree that there's a really pretty weak leadership situation in Milwaukee and the Milwaukee area and statewide when it comes to someone being the central advocate for quality schools and someone who's willing to light a fire under people when things aren't going well. Frankly, in a lot of these cities, you know, Boston comes to mind also, where there's been a lot of energy put into improving schools, it involves either a really engaged, assertive mayor, sometimes an engaged, assertive governor, sometimes both. We don't really have either here. The mayor of Milwaukee has his hands full, I guess, in City Hall, but he's really not very involved in the school scene and never has been. He's been in office since 2004. And that's one thing I suspect both Dr. Driver and Abby Andrich were thinking about, is that kind of leadership. Or the business community has been pretty fractured and sometimes on the sidelines.
And another issue then, in getting back to the issue of vouchers, at least of concern to me, is I'm wondering if there isn't greater religious segregation of students, since over 80% of the voucher schools are sponsored by churches and religious groups. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's I think it's a factual statement that there's I guess you could call religious segregation, in that kids are in large numbers going to schools where everyone there is pretty much of the same religious background as them, whether it's Christian denominations, Catholic, Lutheran, general Christian schools. There's several Jewish schools and Muslim schools in Milwaukee, and you know, you're not going to find kids too much of other religions in those schools. Is that good or bad? I wouldn't want to touch that question because it's so much
yes.
a matter of opinion. And I don't think, though, that the voucher schools or the charter schools are really much different than the public schools, at least not in Milwaukee, and I don't think in Racine when it comes to racial and economic segregation, because all of those schools are so strongly, at least a very large majority of them, are racially and economically segregated already, no matter what sector they're in. I mean, you can pretty much name any school in Milwaukee with just a handful of exceptions, and I'll tell you it's racial and ethnic identity. And I'm talking about probably, you know, 80-plus percent of its students, if not 100% of its students. Some of the big high schools are a little more diverse, but I think within the school itself they're not necessarily much better. But we live in a very segregated time when it comes to race and ethnicity.
Yes.
And vouchers have neither particularly helped nor hurt that. They just become another dimension of it.
You know, as you're speaking here, it makes me think of maybe we're short of data. Maybe we're short of information on which to make our decisions. And therefore, that's why it's so complex and so challenging to decide what do we do and where do we go?
Data for making school selection?
Yeah, or no, data about the results of schools and what they are able to do.
Well, maybe. Overall, things are much better on that score than they used to be.
Uh-huh.
In that, and the two things. One is that the private schools that are getting money, and this is true anywhere in Wisconsin. We've got a statewide voucher program that's just beginning to grow. Racine, Milwaukee, all of those schools have to take the state tests and report them. So that was a big step towards across the board understanding what schools are doing, because there was many years when they didn't. And now, last year was the first time that the private schools are, again, the ones that are taking public money, are in the state report card system. The state report cards, school by school and district by district, I'd agree with something that Abby Andrews said in that column I wrote a week ago, that they're not perfect. They'll get better, I think, over time, but they are the best handle we've ever had on how schools of all kinds are doing. They do have tons of data, not just test scores, but graduation rates, attendance, tardiness, the number of kids progressing from year to year in terms of their state test score ratings, variety of other things. They got a lot of data. One problem is you kind of have to be a data wonk to know how to find it all.
Yes.
I don't think your typical parent knows how to check a state report card. They're not easy to find on the DPI website, and they're not easy to understand once you find them. But nonetheless, this bank of data is there, and it's very extensive.
Okay. Maybe the problem is we do have the data, but maybe we don't have the analysis of the data that's interpreting it for parents and community members and so forth. I want to just put in a plug for my previous program. My previous program, I interviewed a professor by the name of Jack Schneider from the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, and he has a book out called Beyond Test Scores, published by Harvard University Press, and he's maintaining that schools don't have enough or aren't putting out enough data in terms of what they are doing with kids and that sort of thing. Maybe the raw data are there and the high school graduations are there, rates are there, and the test data is there from the standardized test. But he's arguing that there's more information about, you know, how do children relate to their teachers and teachers to the students that should be available, but just simply isn't available these days.
He might be right. I don't coin much expertise on that. I mean, a lot of the things people, both adults and kids, like about schools and a lot of the ways in which they excel or don't excel are fairly intangible. So they aren't easy to measure and they aren't easy to do on a basis that you can compare school after school or even teacher in room A and teacher in room B next door. It's really hard to compare when it comes to intangible things. And those intangible things can make such a difference. Or things where there isn't really a clear grade, like music or art or some of the even some academic subjects where grades aren't so clear, like foreign languages or something.
Right, and he was arguing that different schools might be better for different students. And so forth. So therefore, we need to know those nuances. At this point, I want to remind our listeners that this is your host, Dwayne Olson, and you're listening to Education Matters on WGTD HD at 91.1 on your radio dial. From Gateway Technical College, Kenosha, Wisconsin, today I'm visiting with Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School, about current developments in Wisconsin public education, with emphasis on urban education. Before taking his position at Marquette, Mr. Borsuk wrote on education for the Journal Sentinel and currently writes an education column for the Sunday Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Now back to our program. I want to sort of shift gears a little bit here. I first became directly involved in public education as a high school teacher some 50-plus years ago. Thinking in terms of my own preparation as a high school teacher with a bachelor's degree and then later a master's degree, it seems to me that teaching requires greater knowledge and skills today than I possessed. It all seems to me that the school year needs to be extended into the summer months to provide time for teachers to develop curriculum, participate in in-depth service activities to learn how to work with kids with emotional challenges, etc., not to mention providing students with classes and experiences as well as remediation that cannot be provided in Wisconsin's 180-day school year. Given the current shortage of teachers, what might be the case for extending the school year and extending teachers' contracts?
It seems like things were simpler years ago.
yes, you're right. I'm proud of that.
I understand your feeling that it's gotten more complicated, and it might even be objectively true. I think the needs of kids, the circumstances they live in outside of school have gotten more complicated. Just in the last couple of years, I've been hearing from so many people involved in school, teachers, administrators, anybody, about how many more kids these days have mental health issues than used to be. So the job's certainly gotten more complicated. As for whether the school year should be extended, just this morning I was visiting a charter school that's opening this fall in Milwaukee, and I stopped by to talk to them how they're doing. And they're going to have a school year that starts maybe the third week of August and goes to mid-June. So that's about a month more than, say, Milwaukee Public Schools is going to do. I know you could find studies that would say this is good. You could find studies that say it actually doesn't accomplish that much. So much would depend on the quality of the school itself or the teachers and teaching. More time in school can just be more time and not necessarily more learning, or it can be really an advantage, especially if you do more enrichment. Dr. Driver, when she was superintendent of Milwaukee Public Schools, had the notion of continuing the school year at the length it was, but starting earlier in August, ending in late May, and then having, in effect, an extra month. She called it the J term, J for June. That would be enrichment programs. It would be programs to catch up kids who were behind. It would just be a tenth month to try to do better with a lot of kids. And that really didn't get the state funding that she wanted. It didn't establish itself as too popular. And there's some expansion in summer school offerings in Milwaukee, but it's not what, to the degree she wanted. That all said, whenever the idea of like a year-round school or 11 months or something has come up, I think there's an awful lot of people, and I'm not talking only about teachers, who want the summer off. I think kids want the summer off. Parents want the people somehow think like summer vacation is a constitutional right.
Yes.
So the resistance to it when it's been proposed to really lengthen the school year has often been pretty high. And there are ways, fortunately, a lot of kids do it, and unfortunately, a lot of kids don't. There are ways to make summer an enrichment time.
Yes.
Right now. There's so many programs out there, and there's so many things parents and kids could be doing that are actually learning experiences. You don't have to take the summer off.
It seems to me, too, that we're heading toward more active learning instead of just textbook kinds of learning. And active learning, then, I would think, takes more time.
I'd agree with that. I'd agree with it both as a trend and as an observation that you know, I've been in classrooms where it was, you know, they're doing a lot of individualized or small group learning, and the teacher's sort of sitting on the side and meeting with a few kids at a time. And you kind of, I remember once walking into a classroom and looking around saying, I'm not sure this teacher's actually doing anything, and all these kids are sort of on their own. But once you began watching for a bit and listening to what was going on, you realized this actually required the teacher to know pretty much where every kid was on every subject and individualize their guidance and education. It was actually much harder work and required much more both commitment and talent even. You know, standing in front of the classroom and everybody turned the page, now we're going to the next page in our history textbook. That's kind of a fading style of teaching. And the new styles do require a lot of energy on the teacher's part.
And a shifting of gears on their part, too. And so they need, I think, the time to do the research on curriculum and so forth to develop that curriculum. So I guess here's my part of my argument then for extending the contracts for teachers so that they can really develop some whiz-bang kinds of experiences for kids in their classes.
I've talked fairly often with some national education advocates. I'm thinking of one in particular, a guy named Mark Tucker, who's looked at school systems all around the world, especially the ones that are, by several measures, doing considerably better and than American systems in as far as how their students are succeeding. And one of his most urgent pieces of advice is that American schools as a whole give teachers way too little time for preparation and collaboration.
Yes.
And the hallmarks of school districts in places like Singapore or Japan, or everyone always says Finland. Are schools where the teachers have much better paths to preparing for how to teach their kids and figuring along with their colleagues what works.
Oh, okay. Before I forget it, I talked to you before we went on the air about what have you read recently, so you said that you had something that you would like to share with our listeners, and I've had that question on with you before, but never gotten to it, so here's your chance.
Well, I don't always have a good answer to that. Sometimes I wouldn't want anyone to know what I'm reading. You know, I'm not quite at the comic book level, but at the moment I'm reading a book that I think is really important, and it's also quite readable. It's not a really technical kind of piece. As a context, I'd say I think there's a huge shift going on in the last couple of years, and I think it's going to increase. It's for sure showing up in Racine and in Milwaukee and maybe in, I think, nationwide in many ways, of putting a lot more emphasis on the social and emotional needs of kids and the impact of trauma in kids' lives, especially really early years. And by trauma, I mean anything from living in a household where there's domestic abuse or negligence. Really common experiences like divorce can be very traumatic. The death of a relative, being in the company of violence, I mean, in your neighborhood, you know, in the proximity of violence. And any number of stresses like that, being really unsure where I'm going to sleep tonight because we are having housing problems. So the impact of trauma on kids is getting a great deal of attention, and the notion that if you dealt with some of these problems, school performance and the ultimate success of the kids would go up sharply, I think that's a really important shift in thinking, and we'll see how much it is in programming, I mean, what schools actually do or what's offered to kids. All that said, there's a book, it's called The Deepest Well. It's been out for 3 or 4 months, I believe, by a pediatrician from San Francisco named Nadine Burke Harris, and she's the kind of person. She gave a TED talk several years ago that was like one of the most watched TED talks ever. And she was running a clinic in a high poverty area of San Francisco, and just realized and came on research then to support this, that the higher the level of trauma in a child's life, the bigger their health problems and the bigger their academic problems ultimately.
Yes.
Too. So this is her story of how she reached this conclusion and what she thinks should be done about it. Like I said, it's very readable. She's really, I wouldn't say it's fun to read, but it's not hard to read. Again, it's called The Deepest Well. So I'm reading that now, and I think that's a voice that people should really be aware of and give thought to.
And, you know, thinking in terms of that, and thanks for that recommendation, it makes me think that what would the most school districts do in terms of providing information to teachers on this particular topic, this important topic? And I would think, you know, they would give maybe a couple hours of in-service and that's it, and send them people with a blessing. And that's not enough in this day and age. And that's why I guess I'm arguing for extended time in the summertime to get at these things and treat them in depth?
Those are really good questions. I mean, if you talk to almost any school district these days, rich, poor, suburban, city, whatever the ethnic makeup, anything like that, they'll say, oh, we're working on social-emotional learning, or we're developing our programs in trauma-informed education. How much that really is getting down to the classroom level or the real kid level and how much impact it's having, I don't know. I think, like most of these things, some schools are really doing it well and some are probably just paying mostly lip service to it. But there really is a shift to how to deal with kids' needs. And I mean, to your point, one of the things about schools in today's world, they're being asked to do more and more in terms of meeting kids' needs, not only their social-emotional needs, but oftentimes their physical needs, food, clothing, toiletries.
Yes.
You know, helping make sure that kids have a place to stay tonight. So school is a refuge for a lot of kids from really traumatic situations that they live in, that's the safe place they go to, where they see the same adult every day and have steady relationships and so on, their friends. So there is an argument to say the more time you're in school, the more you're in a good environment.
And teachers need to work with one another to find out how are you addressing this and what can I do in terms of dealing with these kids, et cetera.
Totally agreed.
In closing, is there anything else that you want to add? Because our time is fast closing out here, Alan.
Yeah. Well, we're going into a governor's election, legislative elections, and then in short order, we'll be going into a new state budget come the start of 2019, and that's going to be really interesting. I think there's been a shift. I know there's been a shift in public sentiment, at least according to the Marquette Law School poll, which I actually work on a bit, that more people think schools are important, that funding schools adequately is important. It's one of the reasons you're seeing Governor Walker saying he's, you know, an education governor now, which, because he's reading the public sentiment, how that's going to show up in the next state budget. So consider this the early heads up to pay attention to the next state budget, which means paying attention to the governor's election first here.
So to our radio audience, we say thank you for being with us today as we visited with Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School. Mr. Borsuk currently writes an education column for the Sunday Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Alan, I wish you well in your task of helping Journal Sentinel readers understand what is happening in Wisconsin PK-12 education. Yours is a most important endeavor for our students, our citizens, and our state. If this is your host, Dwayne Olson, thanking you for being with us today.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again. That's what keeps you coming back. Visit jackandrea.com for more information. Support for WGTD comes from Piasecki Althouse, hosting Grief Share, a support group program for adults grieving the death of someone close, running every Wednesday from July 25th through October 17th, from 5:30 to 7 p.m. To register,